Welcome to Money Sense. I'm Julie Ellenbecker, president of Ellenbecker Investment Group. EIG believes in the importance of education, allowing people to gain the knowledge to feel confident in their personal decisions. This show highlights the unique financial perspectives of its many guests, including economists, attorneys, book authors, business owners, and tax professionals. It is provided for general information purposes only and does not consider your particular investment objectives or financial situation and is not intended as recommendations appropriate for you. Before acting on information on this show, strongly consider seeking advice from your own financial advisor. The opinions expressed on Money Sense do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Ellenbecker Investment Group employees and leaders. Please enjoy today's show.
Money Sense is brought to you by Ellenbecker Investment Group, four-time recipient of the Better Business Bureau Torch Award for business ethics and integrity. Ellenbecker Investment Group is the only Wisconsin investment company to receive this prestigious award more than once by providing exceptional planning and extraordinary service each and every day. Go to ellenbecker.com and listen to Money Sense Saturdays at 2 and Sundays at noon.
Welcome to Money Sense. I'm Jamie Williams, wealth advisor for Ellenbecker Investment Group. Ellenbecker Investment Group is located in Pewaukee, just north of I-94, between Highway 164 and Highway F. We're in Ridgeview Corporate Park. We're also located in the village of Whitefish Bay in the Equitable Bank building across from Winkies. We also service clients in Bonita Springs, Florida. Visit ellenbecker.com for more details. Today, we'd like to welcome back our special guest, Dick Schiller of Pavlik Investment Advisors. Dick and his partner, Terry, have been longtime strategic partners of EIG. And Dick, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Jamie. Thanks for having me again. Great to be here.
Absolutely. Oh, my gosh. So we've got a lot to talk about today. We're halfway through the year, and it's been quite a bumpy ride the first half, I would say.
It has been, yeah. We were just talking before the show that the last we had sat down and spoke was February 26th, which was just before really some of the turmoil came in to play. And it's kind of interesting. We've come a little bit full circle. We're probably in the markets, really both stock and bond markets, back to a very similar spot to where we were when we last recorded that show.
Absolutely. And I would just want to preface our conversation today by saying that you and your partner, Terry, have a very integral, important role that you play for us here at EIG because you manage our fixed income, some of our fixed income portfolios for certain portfolios that we have for clients. And, you know, that's, you know, the relationship you guys have had with us going back, I think, about 15 years or so.
Yes, it's a long time standing relationship going back to Terry Pavlik, my partner and also father-in-law with Karen Ellenbecker, and you know, really evolved over the years and continue to try to find as many ways that we can help provide value for EIG and your clients.
Thank you. And, you know, I would say this, there's so many things, and, you know, we appreciate the partnership so much because of the transparency level of what you guys do for us. You think about what people have in terms of access to different investment vehicles. And, you know, of course, there are a lot of different funds that we use, mutual funds and exchange-traded funds, packaged products that, you know, certainly have a place in most client portfolios. But, you know, nonetheless, when we talk about investing in individual bonds, let's talk about that for a minute in terms of what types of bonds you guys like to, you know, kind of focus on for these portfolios.
Yeah, certainly. So just like you mentioned, we run what's called SMAs or separately managed accounts for Ellenbecker and their clients. So what that means is that each portfolio for each client, each portfolio of bonds, no two are necessarily the same. Potentially, they could be very close to the same if they have the exact same start date and time. But in general, I would say that no two bond portfolios look the exact same. That said, they have very similar characteristics. Investment-grade bonds is definitely a key characteristic. We have to maintain an investment grade rating with either S&P or Moody's. Secondly, we stay, our traditional bond ladder strategy is 10 years. We also have shortened that on a customization basis for a number of Ellenbecker clients. That's driven partly by liquidity needs and or could be driven by their age. Maybe an 80 or 85 year old client might not want a 10 year bond ladder. How we've structured that is let's just say it's a 10-year bond ladder. We want to keep and maintain diversification as best as possible across those 10 years. An example of when it might be tough to find diversification is if you go back and rewind back to when oil was negative $30, $40 a barrel, a lot of turmoil in the oil markets.
That was like 5 years ago,
almost exactly, right? When you would do searches and screens, our goal is to maximize return and minimize risk, right? So, we could buy a basket full of Microsoft bonds, but their trading currently would be at a credit quality healthier than the U.S. government. And I think we'll talk about that a little bit later. But, some people say, well, why don't you go buy Microsoft bonds? And the answer is, well, you're going to earn 3.5% on that bond annualized. They're like, well, I want to earn 4 or 5. And so we feel like we can stretch credit quality. We hold a lot of, if we go to banks, right, some Goldman Sachs, some JP Morgan. If we stay within technology, we might not be a Microsoft, but we might be an HP. I see you have an HP computer in front of me, so thank you for supporting HP. But we have a number of, in 2035, specifically when we've been rolling the bond ladders, we've been adding to a number of those bond positions out for HP specifically in 2035. The rates of return that we're getting 10 years out down the ladder when we are rolling those bonds has been anywhere from 5.8% to low sixes, 6.2%, 6.3%. That HP bond specifically out to 25 has that same coupon right in that range. So the beautiful thing is they're trading all around par. Rates in this period have been relatively flat, even though there's a lot of talk of the bond market. It has hit the headlines, especially during some of the tariff turmoil issues. But really, looking at historically where we've come just since the last time we sat down, we're just like the stock portfolio. We're pretty much largely in this very similar place, all while collecting sizable coupon interest for clients.
I'm glad you brought that up, because the last time we got together in February, we were kind of in a place where the stock market had kind of achieved its all-time high level. And then as we sit here today, we're in the last few days of June, before the close of the second quarter, if I'm not mistaken, I think today we probably are going to hit the all-time record high in the S&P.
Yeah, it sure seems like it. When I look at the peak to trough, the peak was February 19th, about a week before we last sat down, and we had slowly been just trickling down. Felt like more just an exhale of a good run that we had in 2024, and I remind clients often 2023 and 2024 were both up greater than 20% years in the market. So even if we end flat, if we have a call, let's just say conservatively, 20%, 20%, 0% year, 40% over 3 years, that's still above average, right? So we're still trending positively. Although we peaked on February 19th, the real needle mover was on April 2nd, right after the end of the first quarter, when Trump had proposed his tariffs that, the market and many investors had originally thought it was largely just going to be a Trump versus China type of trade war. But I still remember watching on CNBC, seeing him hold up those big billboards with countries that you and I probably couldn't place on a map or even know existed. But
there were many.
Assigning tariff percentages to all of them. And I think that's what took the market by surprise, both how wide a breadth the assigning of tariff rates were, and then also some of the rates being used to calculate. I kind of stopped paying attention. It was jumping around so much from 110 to 130 to 145. And then realistically, what mattered and what was important was about a week later, April 9th, April 10th, I say, I'm going to put a 90-day pause. And some of that, at the time, the headlines were because of the bond vigilantes, which we'll talk about a little bit later. Mm-hmm. But, that April 9th when call it whatever you want, some call it, the taco trade. Trump always chickens out, which is so funny. Some people say he just had a change of heart. Some people said, it was the stock market and bond market that changed his mind. But what matters is that from that point on, we have had this really nice rally. We've recovered the 20% drop. Right. We're back to near all-time highs again.
Yeah, that's incredible. I know that there were a lot of people that were paying close attention during that period of time. And as with our clients that we've had relationships with, some shorter than longer, but some more than 25 plus years, you know, we want to make sure that we let our clients know that we're have a strategy. We want to remain disciplined. And during that period of time, thankfully, you know, no one had any dire concerns. So no one got hurt jumping out of the roller coaster mid-ride, right? So we've kind of made it all the way back to the station. And the second half of this year, we'll see, you know, what happens. That 90-day pause that Trump put on, I think, expires in the next, what, 30 days or so?
Yeah, yeah. So the 90-day pause will actually be July 9th. So depending on when this interview is aired, put a big asterisk by this, because I'm guessing we're going to have some volatility when we approach that time frame. So no one really knows what we have in store.
And there have been so many developments since April during this quarter that, you know, we'll see how things really work out. But nonetheless, so we're meeting with Dick Schiller of Pavlik Investment Advisors. Dick is a chartered financial analyst, and he is an expert with fixed income investing. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back after this these messages. Welcome back to Money Sense. This is Jamie Williams, and here with Dick Schiller. Dick has been on our show a number of times, and we are going to be talking today about the first half of 2025 as we approach the second half here. We're just within a couple days of the end of the second quarter, and before the break, we were talking about, you know, kind of the market. I wanted to just ask Dick, where do you think we sit, like, in terms of bond yields and interest rates right now? The Federal Reserve just met last week. You know, what are your general thoughts on that?
Yeah, certainly. So if you just take a step back and look at the Bloomberg U.S. Aggregate Bond Index, which is quite a mouthful, but in other words, it's the most commonly used index as a benchmark for U.S. corporate general investment grade bonds. And that index is still in a drawdown, meaning it still is not back at its prior peak of 2021. So going back all the way where it's currently been 58 months, and that the maximum peak to trough drop was about 17%, which is unheard of in bonds. That actually has never happened since, as long as the data goes back, that we have clean data. Both has never happened that deep of a drawdown, 17%, and also hasn't happened that long of a drawdown in duration for 58 months. So how much have we recovered? We're about 5% off the highs. So what basically a big picture idea, when you own fixed income, you are collecting the coupon interest, and these returns are total return data. So you've been collecting the coupon interest, let's just call it 3-4% since 2021. We're now in 2025, so that's 4 years, and we're still in a drawdown on a total return basis. So it just goes to show the magnitude of the pullback in price, especially for longer dated bond positions. So think 10 to 20 to even 30 years out. You have many bonds that are included in the U.S. Aggregate Bond Index that are trading 30, 40, at one point even 50% off their highs. So massive pullbacks. One of the big ways that that we've been able to really insulate EIG clients from that. You know, I'd love to say we're the best bond pickers out there in the market, but it really is just the strategy. And, you know, credit Terry Pavlik for that. But this idea of the shorter you stay to maturity, the less interest rate risk you are exposed to. So that means that, you know, we're not, if interest rates rise, which for 40 years they never did, come 2021, they now have been rising for really 21, 22, 23, and we've been in a pretty flat interest rate environment. Higher for longer has played true. But, you know, here we are back at these levels, and we've largely insulated. I don't think we have any portfolios, even with inception dates of 2021, that are still in a negative drawdown. Most of them are substantially positive. And you compare that to the index of 6.4% being where it's down off the peak. You know, I think that's tremendous value that has been added. A lot of that being that 10-year average ladder. If you think 10% coming due per year, your average duration, average maturity is about 4.5 years. So over this period, five bonds, if you have 10 bonds, five bonds, slugs of bonds, or 50% of the portfolio is already matured, right? We've already made back our $100 per bond back, which is huge. So, you know, the going forward, where do we go from here? I've spent a lot of time looking back, but what's really important is where do we go from here? And the now going in yields for new money into the bond portfolio is over 5%. It's pulled back within the last week or so, but for a time period there, we were over 5.5%. I would say if we created one today, it would be closer to 5.2%. That's a mix of, you know, 4.7% bonds on the very short end, all the way up to those, you know, 5.8 to 6% bonds like that HP bond I was talking about in 2035. So we do have, you know, it's not just bonds are offering portfolio stability and diversification, which yes they are, but the second piece of this is they're actually providing a decent level of return,
absolutely,
both after fees. And also the nice thing is, although, you know, we get things thrown at me if I said inflation is low, I get it. We had a 20% jump up and it hasn't come down, but the rate of change has slowed to now having CPI readings in the 2.5% range. That 5 to 5.5% income that you're making on your bonds is well in excess of that CPI rating right now.
Right.
So, you know, I'm encouraged. I love the fact that even larger bond portfolios were able to make interest on our interest, as in, you know, we have to have a certain percent. I can't just buy like one bond at a time. But if we're collecting coupon interest, some of these in the thousands of dollars when we're getting payments in, we're being that much more active by getting that cash back out and buying new slugs of bonds.
So I was going to ask you about the recent downgrading of the U.S. debt. And if you have any particular, like, has that happened before in history?
It has, yeah. I believe S&P and Moody's, the recent downgrade was Fitch, I believe. And S&P and Moody's had already pulled one rung off the very, very top, and Fitch had joined them. I mean, there's this term that's been around for a long time. I believe Ed Yardeni was the original one who coined it,
the bond vigilantes.
Yeah,
you
exactly
hear about
right.
that a little bit in the headlines, and I've not many people are really familiar with what that is. So
yeah.
I don't know.
So what that means is that when investors globally are worried about the level of the U.S. debt, national debt, and the interest rates that we're paying on that debt, there's a concern that the U.S. won't be able to meet its debt obligations. So if someone is worried that they're not going to be able to pay on their debt, what does the market do? The market sells off the bond, so the price comes down and the yield goes up. So yields are rising. And a lot of this going back to the tariff turmoil in early April, and definitely there were some headlines of the bond vigilantes were what pushed Trump to change course. And I actually believe he did make some comment out there that he was watching the fixed income markets and what was going on at that time period where yields were rising higher, right? So yields were moving higher, bond prices were falling. I think if you also, you have to put it into context. If you take a step back and look at like even just the year-to-date 10-year, we kind of started the year at 4.5 and maybe we're at 4.3 today. You know, it
exactly.
really hasn't moved all
right.
that much, but that move during that short window was from about 4 to 4.5. So there was a movement in there, but the bond vigilantes were back and forth. Since that rate has come back down a little bit, you don't hear about it as much, but I don't think we've necessarily seen the end of the story either.
No, I don't think so. And I mean, as far as the yield curve is concerned, it's pretty healthy looking right now overall, because I think the 30-year is at like 4.9 and the 2-year is at like less than 4. I think it's at like 3.9. So, you know, that's one thing that people are always asking about, especially people that might invest in things like fixed instruments at a bank, like a CD or something. And I remember that from my long ago days in banking, when I sat behind the banker's desk and, you know, the start of my career, people would come in and say, can't you do better than, you know, the last time, or why is my rate going down? And it's a result of one of the risks out there that exist in the overarching world of investing. It's reinvestment rate risk, interest rate risk, and there are other risks, obviously, that we're paying close attention to. But what types of risks that with this current rate environment might you see, and the benefit of if the Fed does start to change its posture and go more dovish on rates?
Yeah, I mean, great points, Jamie. I have a lot to say about this, and maybe it'll carry over into the next segment as well. But you know, in brief, the issue with CDs is that they're generally not very long in term. So we have this bonds you can go 30, 50 years, right? We're going out only 10 years, but most investors in CDs, at least from what I've heard from clients, even I don't actively go into banks asking, you know, what type of rates and terms can I get, but most. What I've heard from clients is, you know, they're offering me 6 months or they're offering me a 7 month CD. And I'm like, boy, that's short. And why is it so short? Mm-hmm. And the answer is because there's expectations that the Fed will be cutting rates in the second half of the year. So, you know, the banks don't want to lend long because in 6 months from now, that CD rate, whatever it is today, is probably going to be 50 basis points or 0.5% lower.
Sure. And banks are businesses too. And they're obviously, they have a structured environment with those things that for them make sense to offer certain terms. So we've been meeting with Dick Schiller, who is our fixed income analyst and specialist with EIG's bond portfolios with Pavlik Investment Advisors. We're going to take a quick break. And when we get back, we're going to talk a little bit more about, you know, interest rates and put a few other thoughts out there around the current state of some of the global capital markets. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Money Sense. We're talking with Dick Schiller of Pavlik Investment Advisors, having a great conversation about the first half of 2025, talking about bond yields and, you know, just kind of before the break, we ended up kind of touching on the Federal Reserve and, you know, some interest rates. You know, Dick, you know, you had something you wanted to share about bank CDs, and then maybe we could kind of then go into what the Federal Reserve next steps actions are that they're looking at right now.
Yeah, for sure. You know, I see this a couple times a quarter, and I tend to find it with some of the elderly clients in the book that I think it's a generational thing that you know, clients sometimes want to just really feel like they want to hunt for the highest CD rate possible. And some will drive, you know, long and far and take their cash in a suitcase down the street. And, you know, it's just a little funny to me that at some point then someone just goes, you know what, this really isn't worth it for another 10 or 20 basis points. And I'm like, right. You know, I just remind people that, hey, look, like the money market fund in this environment is still over four. It's mm-hmm. I think it was about 4.13 the last I checked. That's the Schwab Value Advantage Money Market Fund. If you are fortunate enough to have, you know, over a million in it, you can even get another 25 basis points out of that. So 4.3% and a little bit higher than that. So that's you have perfect liquidity with the money market fund. There is no lockup period by owning the money market fund. You know, that CD, if you buy a 7 month CD and you go to the bank and say, you know, I changed my mind, like they're going to charge you a pretty hefty penalty if you want to get your money back. So there's no such thing with the money market fund. So, you know, and on the investment grade bond side, we're in general making rates of return that are higher than the CD rates. They're not necessarily 2-3 percentage points higher, but they're 1-2 percentage points higher. So that's, you know, one point. And then the second point is we can go out a lot further in time than what the banks are offering now, right? Generally between 6 to 12 months. If we buy that HP bond going out to 2035 with a 6% coupon, it's going to pay you 6% every year for the next 10 years. And finally mature at $100 per bond in 2035. So, you know, I've never heard of a bank that's going to offer you a 10-year CD, right? So it's a little bit comparing apples to oranges, but I do believe that we provide a lot of value in net of fees, sure. Right, including our fees, that the client is net better off on a risk-adjusted return basis with the strategy.
Oh yeah, and certainly for like a core, you know, kind of strategy within your portfolio, that makes a lot of sense. So, I wanted to ask you about what lies ahead in terms of the rate environment. You know, 30-year fixed mortgage rates are still hovering in around the high sixes, low sevens. Last time I checked, housing prices have been kind of slowing down in terms of like the increases that we've been seeing. We still have an inventory shortage out there that's probably not going to be solved anytime soon. So I think there's a lot of pressure right now on the Fed to make the right decision. And it's a challenge, right? Because I think in the past and the shows that you've been on, you know, they've changed their outlook over the last 5 years just because of excess, you know, money in the system and a lot of other things. But what would you think is the biggest challenge that the Fed faces right now with trying to navigate this?
Yeah, you know, it's fascinating that the Jerome Powell, head of the Federal Reserve, is one guy's seat and job that I do not envy. He is a very tough job and is often under fire from both sides of the political aisle.
Right.
And, you know, it's also impacting, you know, everyone's lives in the day to day. Most directly for our investment portfolio, it is impacting the shortest end of the yield curve. So that is what the federal funds rate moves. So that's the federal, that money market fund I was describing in the low fours. Right now, the expectation is the Fed will cut twice. So 2 0.25% cuts for the rest of the year. So that totals 0.5%. So that's going to directly impact the money market fund rate at 4.1 today. I would guess by the end of the year, unless we have any exogenous shocks, that, you know, that would be at 3.6. So it takes 0.5% off it, and 3.6 by the end of the year. So the Fed has basically come out and said, boy, there is a lot of stuff specifically related to tariffs that we weren't aware of coming into the year, the magnitude and the breadth of tariffs. And by the way, we have, you know, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act that's expiring at the end of the year that we don't quite know where that's going to land. The House and Senate have both passed proposals that have some similarities, but also a lot of differences that need to be worked out. So what Jerome Powell and the head governors at the Federal Reserve says, we're just going to sit on our hands and wait. We're going to see how this all works out. You hear the wait and see approach that they're doing. So, you know, currently they're in that 4.25 to 4.5% range, and they're fine sitting there. Their dual mandate is lower inflation and keeping unemployment low. The inflation numbers have improved. I'm not saying that we are having deflation. We definitely are not. But the rate of the pace of growth has come down from where we were 9% in 21 and 22 to now 2.5%. The job isn't finished, as Jerome Powell will say. It's, you know, we're at 2.5% and he wants it at 2.
Mm-hmm.
So there's still a little bit of work there to go. On the employment side, you know, really structural full employment, which means we're always going to have some unemployed people in the workforce, but we really view the full employment rate as a 4% unemployment rate, so 96% employed, and we're currently at 4.2. So that has been going up. What interesting is, with, you know, the low was 3.4, so it has triggered the Claudia Sahm rule up over 0.5%, but it hasn't been a, you know, steady 4.2, 4.3, 4.4. You're not like, oh my gosh, this is going up, you know, and it's, who knows, it might spike from here, but it's been relatively steady. So both of those inflation metrics and unemployment metrics that I shared, and then you combine that with, well, we don't know where tariffs are going.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know where tax policy is going. The constant theme that I keep hearing myself say is, we don't know, right? So the Fed takes that and says, well, if we don't know, we're not going to make any rash decisions either way. So we're going to, quote, wait and see. So that's what's keeping them where they are. I think an overnight rate in the low to mid 4% does mean that we're going to have higher rates as we go further out on the curve. And that's what we're seeing in that investment grade bond market. You know, those rates of between 4.7 on the short end to 6 on the long end, yep, out 10 years, that makes sense with that about 1%, 1.5% spread to the U.S. 10-year Treasury rate.
Right. And so year to date, the S&P is up 4.6% as of, well, close of market today. And I wanted to shift the thought because the word tariff, right, and some of those things kind of inspired some shifts in the market throughout the mid part of this year, I guess, toward the beginning of the second quarter in terms of international kind of attractiveness to international investing. So I wanted to ask you if you had any thoughts, because we're positive. You know, the U.S. as a country is positive in terms of total return in global equities. But it's astounding to me to see that there are several countries, I'm guessing probably at least 18 or so, that are north of 20% for the year. So any thoughts on that in terms of what would drive that?
Yeah, it really is fascinating, because you even if you knew the extent of the tariffs being proposed, I know they're in a pause right now, so we'll see where it shakes out. But, you know, you'd say, well, boy, the rest of the world is going to struggle with that backdrop. And actually the exact opposite has happened, right? The international stocks have outperformed the U.S. And I'm looking at a chart that's dated a little bit more than the up 4% on the S&P 500. But as of June 20th, so the international stocks ex-U.S. were actually up 16% on average, compared to the U.S. up low single digits, let's call it. So also, I think it is good to put that in some context. I always say, when in doubt, zoom out. And when you do zoom out, and if you look at a 10-year chart, this would look like a little blip because the U.S. has just dominated the rest of the world really since the great financial crisis. And a lot of that has been driven by the big bad technology companies that we have in this country. They are massive cash generation machines. I'm referring to the Microsoft, Apple, NVIDIA, Facebook, Meta, of the world, that are U.S. domiciled stocks. They're in our indices, and they have really nowhere else across the globe has been able to compete with those businesses. So it's propelled our markets much higher.
Yep, incredible growth through that technology sector. And we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, maybe we could pick up right there and just kind of talk about that and then some other themes before we kind of wrap up with a few thoughts on planning and kind of bringing it back to our clients and what they should be thinking about. We'll be right back after this break. Welcome back to Money Sense. This is Jamie Williams. We've been having a great conversation with Dick Schiller. Dick was sharing before the break, you know, some thoughts on, you know, the international indexes versus U.S., which, you know, the U.S. has vastly outperformed for long periods of time. So we are going to see years like this happen. But Dick, I was also going to ask you, you know, we've also seen small caps kind of things move a little bit in that space too. Any thoughts on why we're maybe there's attractiveness to that sector as well? Or I shouldn't say sector, but those capital markets.
Yeah. So just rewinding and looking at the first half of the year in its totality, what led the markets lower on the pullback were those large cap Magnificent Seven stocks that we were talking about. Technology was down more than the rest of the market, and the S&P 500, also viewed as the large cap, the largest 500 profitable companies in the U.S. market, is largely dominated by technology stocks. You know, you can call 40% to 50%, depending on how you want to categorize, like an Amazon, a Meta, even though it's in communication services. I think most people consider that technology. So you just have that massive weight, that 40-50% weight in the S&P 500. You compare that to the Russell 2000, which is the small cap index, the 2000 smallest companies in the U.S. And the Russell 2000 was down less than the larger brethren of the S&P 500. So there was a small bout of outperformance there to the downside. What we've seen in this recovery period since mid-April has been those Magnificent Seven stocks coming back with a vengeance. And you see NVIDIA back at 150, right? Above the market cap of Microsoft. It's really, I think it was as low as 90 there. So from 90 to 150 is a heck of a move in 3 months. Year to date, S&P up low single digits, again, with the asterisk that this is as of the last week of June. And the Russell 2000 is actually down 5%. So what happened there was the return back has been driven again by technology stocks. And the Russell 2000, largely not technology names, has lagged the broader indices by about 6-7%. So when in doubt, zoom out. If we were to take a really 10-15-year, really broad look at this, it would actually be quite similar to comparing U.S. versus international names. Yep. Where the S&P 500 has just dominated the Russell 2000, driven by those technology larger names. If you look at it on a sector basis, so put small versus large, growth versus value, put those topics aside and say what sectors are working, what's not. Consumer discretionary is bringing up the rear with the worst performing sector, down about 8%. And if you think consumer discretionary, that's going to be a lot of your names that are most likely the most negatively impacted by tariffs. So I think of a Nike or, you know, really anything that might be importing, maybe clothes, right, from overseas has been negatively impacted. Healthcare, for a couple of its own unique reasons, has been negatively impacted. On the positive side, we have things like industrials has performed very, very well. Some of your defense contractors are in that area, which to no surprise have worked well year to date. Utility names have worked well. And even consumer staples have performed pretty well. But again, we're back, you know, really within a couple percentage points of where we started the year.
Yeah, it's good to see that we're kind of in a, you know, more of a positive ground. And again, the second half is going to be interesting, but I think it takes us all the way back to something that's very important for, you know, investors and advisors to consider, which is how their portfolios are constructed, right? We want to make sure that our clients have got the liquidity that they need, you know, kind of, I call it use case money, so that if we are in a period of volatility or maybe things revert, that we are in a place where we don't really have to worry about it. And, you know, I know we deploy a strategy where we look at income protection, you know, from the standpoint of downside risk and making sure that we have assets in the portfolio that are kind of earmarked like individual bonds, that we have kind of an expected maturity kind of cadence to those that we can plan for, whether it's required minimum distributions, maybe it's gifting to charities through their IRAs, through different strategies that might make sense for our clients. But, you know, I think pulling all this back together and making sure that, you know, we're really looking at that planning side. Dick, did you have any thoughts around where we were with that period of volatility and what mindset investor sentiment looked like?
Yeah, I think it's a great time to just reflect a little bit and think back to what we've experienced. And I, you know, 20% drawdown is not something to take lightly, right? And this was somewhat politically driven, right? So I think there is that element of it that makes it even that much more challenging, especially if you don't agree with the man in power right now. So, you know, I think taking a step back and saying, you know, the time to create action when you feel like you really want to do something was April, right? And we were all feeling that. And the constant message that I was pitching to clients, and Jamie, I'm sure you were too, was, you know, hey, we have a plan in place. Like, let's ignore the headlines for now and try to tune it out, as hard as that sounds. And let's just go back to all the planning things, the goals that we set up at our initial meetings, right, and continue to monitor. You know, remember last meeting we were talking about 529 planning for 10 years out for your child or grandson. You know, when you shift the conversation back to those topics, you get pulled away from the tariff headline of the day, right? Of potentially the hour. And, you know, I think that is really where you want to be. Now, if you're like, look, if this happens again, and the 90-day expiration is July 9th, so there is a chance that we could go back down this road and the markets could pull over again. I think the key thing is to set an asset allocation, to stick to it through thick and thin, and just to, you know, have confidence in it. As hard as that sounds, this confidence that no matter what the market, the world throws at us, we're going to get through it, right? And I'm going to get through it. And so, you know, if you were 60-40 at the time and you say, you know what, I just don't feel like that was really appropriate. I felt super uncomfortable during the pullback. You know what, like, change it to a 50-50 portfolio. Have a little more cash on the sideline. I never encourage people to go all in or all out, 100% to zero or zero to 100. But I also recognize that it feels good to make some sort of move, right? And to fit everyone's personalized, unique, like, risk characteristics, right? Some say we're going to the moon, right? Some say I want to hunker down and be more protective. So it's not really a one-size-fits-all strategy for everyone, but that's where you work with your advisor to find where that level is.
Yeah, and we have a lot of tools in our toolkit that help people understand and kind of illustrate where, you know, some people are audible, some people are visual. Using software where we can kind of put in some variables and some level of predictability around returns might not be like that, you know, that S&P 500 10.5% return every single year going back, but maybe something more modest, like you said, a 50-50 or, you know, whatever might make sense for that individual investor. We can use our tools to help our clients understand that they're on track and that if we're in a down market that they don't need to, you know, think about going back to work after they retired or something like that. So with that, Dick, we do want to say thank you so much again for coming in, sharing your thoughts and ideas with us. We'll have you back again later this year. We'll see how things unfold. So with that, again, we've been meeting with Dick Schiller, Pavlik Investment Advisors, and want to share that Money Sense airs on Saturdays from 2 to 3 p.m. and on Sundays from 12 to 1. If you enjoyed today's show and you want to learn more about us and Ellen Becker's upcoming events, please visit ellenbecker.com or give us a call. We could be reached at 262-691-3200. As always, we hope that we've made a difference with you and your personal well-being financially. Before we plan, before we invest, before we advise, we always listen. So thank you very much, and thanks, Dick, for joining the show.
Thanks for having me, Jamie.